On this episode of Women Behind Bars, one woman was convicted of murdering her own parents.
Virginia Twiner had opportunity or had access to that handgun.
I didn't think I'd even go to trial. And then when I did go to trial, I knew they couldn't get a conviction. I wasn't guilty, okay?
Then Diane Metzger tells her story. She was an alleged cohort in the brutal death of her husband's ex-wife.
And he said, she's dead. And I just, at that point, everything started to move in slow motion.
We know somebody went upstairs, suffocated Martha, wrapped her in a blanket, then they stuffed her in the trunk of the car.
Two women, two brutal crimes. These are the stories of Virginia Twiner and Diane Metzger. On the morning of May 5th, 1988, 54-year-old John Wells was found murdered in his own home, located in rural Pettis County, Missouri.
He'd been shot. It didn't look like a struggle, perhaps somebody that he knew. There was a large amount of blood throughout the living room.
At first, investigators suspected his wife, 49-year-old Marilyn Wells. That was until her body was discovered the following day in a field 8 miles away.
We had a female subject that was located about 40 or 50 feet off into this wooded area. She also had been killed with a single gunshot wound to the chest.
Within 3 days, 26-year-old Virginia Twiner, a financially strapped single mother, was arrested and charged with killing her own father and stepmother in cold blood for money.
I think she went there to try to get money from her father. He refused her. I think she shot him. Her mother was taken out into the country and killed.
She loved her mom, and she loved her dad.
Did Virginia Twiner resort to the murder of her own parents to erase her mounting debts? Or is she an innocent woman who wound up on death row for a crime she didn't commit?
My dad was in the United States Marine Corps. He was stationed in Okinawa, Japan. My birth mother, Ida, is from Sasebo, Japan.
Virginia's parents had two children in Japan. In the early 60s, they were restationed to Oceanside, California, where Virginia and her two other siblings were born.
He was a good father as far as providing for us. We never went hungry. We always had everything that we needed, okay? But if I had to come up with one word to just describe him, the abuse stands out.
In 1967, the couple filed for divorce.
When I was 6, my dad married Marilyn, and she's the one who raised me. I consider her my mom.
Marilyn had 3 children of her own. By 1972, the blended family, including 8 kids, settled into the rural farmland near Sedalia, Missouri. In order to provide for his family, J.D. set up several cash businesses.
J.D. and Marilyn ran 2 local businesses, a restaurant here in Sedalia and a bar in a small neighboring community. Marilyn was primarily running the bar, J.D. was running the restaurant.
Marilyn was the caregiver and the lover and had good relationships that I saw with all the kids. J.D. was a disciplinarian.
In fact, according to Virginia, even as the kids got older, the former Marine continued to rule with an iron fist.
I still remember getting whippings and spankings and stuff. But I think at 15, I finally got an outlet. I loved horses, I love animals. And living on the farm, I always had someplace to go to get away from it.
When Virginia was 16, she met another local teenager named Hugo.
He's about 5'10". He's a country boy, real muscular. I guess that's what attracted me to him, because he was just so strong.
Hugo also represented freedom for the teenager who longed to break free from her father's grasp. Virginia dropped out of high school, married Hugo, and moved with him to his new job as a farmhand in Osceola, some 200 miles away from her father.
My honeymoon was spent in a trailer with no gas, no water, no electricity, nothing. Just a lantern. I was free.
But times only got tougher for the young couple when Virginia gave birth to a baby boy. There was one more mouth to feed.
Dad didn't want us living in Osceola on this farm anymore. He wanted us to move back to Sedalia to keep closer tabs on us.
The financial stress only intensified with the birth of another son. In fact, records show that Virginia and Hugo often relied on bailout loans from JD.
I don't think Hugo was happy that I had a second child so soon. I think I put too much responsibility on him. I remember things changed. He was hitting me, and I went to call the police, and he took the curly wire on the telephone and he wrapped it around my neck. When he was distracted, I run up the stairs and closed the door on him and took off. Got my two boys and got out of there.
She ended up divorced because it was an abusive relationship, and she couldn't take that for her and her children anymore.
In late 1987, after 8 years of marriage, she got divorced and worked at a fast food restaurant to make ends meet. Before long, though, her car was repossessed, and the bank threatened to foreclose on the house she and Hugo had bought together.
Hugo paid her $400 a month support for the kids, and Jenny provided for him the best she could.
By her own admission, Virginia was careless when it came time to pay the bills.
At that time, it was actually just a big party. I just partied all the time. Not drinking or none of that. I just didn't do none of my responsibilities.
In the spring of 1988, Virginia once again turned to her father for financial help, asking him for a loan.
I was very desperate. I needed this loan, okay? Because otherwise my kids was gonna lose their home. My kids was gonna be kicked out of the Catholic school. I had already lost my car.
But this time, the answer was no. Virginia had recently defaulted on an already existing loan of $3,000 from her father. He'd threatened to garnish her wages.
He was mad. My dad was very mad at me. I guess I made maybe three trips down to the restaurant talking to him all together when he finally agreed that he would give me this loan.
According to Virginia, her father had finally agreed to loan her more money. A local bank teller, however, remembers an incident several weeks before his death when J.D. Wells entered the bank with an unusual proclamation.
He said, "My name is John Wells, and I want this bank to know, in case anything happens to me, that within the next few days, I'm going to be making a large deposit to my daughter's account."
So how did Virginia Twetter wind up being accused of murdering her own parents, the two people she says were willing to help her most? When Women Behind Bars continues.
It quickly came to investigators' attention that she was in financial trouble before the homicides and that she was getting herself out of it May 5th, the day the bodies were discovered.
On the morning of May 5th, 1988, J.D. Wells' oldest daughter made a grim discovery as she entered her parents' rural farmhouse outside Sedalia, Missouri.
His daughter, Ann Louse, had went to check on him to see why he wasn't at work that day. And when she came there, she found her father dead.
54-year-old J.D. Wells had been shot once in the back.
Perhaps Mr. Wells was in the master bedroom when he was confronted, and that was used to get him into the living room, and then upon then he was shot.
He was wearing his pajamas. At the kitchen table was his checkbook, a calculator that was on, the television which was on, and a cup of coffee which looked like it was fairly full. It appeared that John had been doing his books, paying some bills, gotten interrupted and ended up shot.
Well, the first thing that caught my eye were the bloody footprints that were on the linoleum of the kitchen in the house. There's always the thought that the one who committed the murder stepped in Mr. Wells' blood and then left that particular clue there in the kitchen area, so it became very important.
As footprints go, it was a fairly distinctive footprint. That is, it showed the sole pattern pretty well.
Investigators collected several .38 caliber shell casings and cigarette butts. Then began the search for J.D.'s wife, Marilyn.
I believe around noon that day, there was another crime scene located about 8 miles from the residence.
Marilyn Wells' body was found in a field. She'd been shot once in the chest with a .38 caliber weapon.
We believe that she was executed here. It's very rural. There's no houses around, nobody to see a crime committed. I think the most important piece of evidence we found besides the body and a bullet that was taken from Mrs. Wells was a piece of blue denim that was found on the barbed wire strand of the fence.
Near Marilyn's body lay a half pack of Marlboros, the same type found inside the Wells home.
I was dismayed to learn that we'd had an homicide, at least doubly dismayed to learn that there were two victims. Because it was a big deal, the local sheriff called in the Mid-Missouri Major Case Squad.
Dozens of members of the Major Case Squad began by interviewing anyone who knew J.D. and Marilyn, including their 8 children. 26-year-old Virginia Twenter revealed that just hours before the murder, she and her 2 boys visited her parents' house.
He was sitting at the table in his overalls, Brighton Bills. My stepmother come in, and me and her went into the living room and was talking. We didn't want to interrupt him.
Virginia says she'd come to pick up an $8,400 loan from her father, more than half of which was to pay for a new car. The first check she'd written to the dealership bounced.
So my father got up from the table, and he walked into the bedroom. And he hollered back and he said, Marilyn, write her out 2 checks. Write one out to David Malamo Motors in the amount of $4,400 and write her one for $4,000. So my stepmother wrote the checks out and I said thank you to my dad.
According to Virginia, she went home, made dinner and put the boys to bed. Sometime before 9 p.m., she decided to go out with a friend to Polo's, a local bar, leaving her roommate Mike to babysit.
Linda Turner had called and said she wanted to go out to Polo's. When I got out there, I didn't see her car, but I seen one of the guys that I was dating going into Polo's with another girl. So I got out of my car and I started to go into Polo's, and I thought, it ain't worth it.
She claimed that she then drove to Knobnostra, 20 miles west of Sedalia, drove around town for a while, and then came back to Sedalia. When she was interviewed a second time, she pretty much stuck with that same story, although she said she had gone clear to Warrensburg.
Virginia also admitted when she got to Warrensburg, she didn't just drive around.
As I was pulling out of Hardee's, there was another guy I had dated, Robert, driving by, and I honked, and when he looked up and noticed me, he motioned me to go into the parking lot at McDonald's. It's like, 9 o'clock now. When Robert walked up to the car, he had a friend with him, and he introduced him as Steve. And he was a really nice looking guy. So Robert asked me, Steve could have, I too, I don't know, asked me if I wanted to go out to the park with him. So I said, yeah. I just followed them back down the road to this park area. Well, we ended up having sex.
And she inferred that the reason she hadn't mentioned that originally is because she was embarrassed to say anything about that.
I was very, very ashamed of myself. Very, very, can't believe I did this thing.
The prosecution says it was unable to locate a Robert Arnell, or the man she called Steve, the 2 men Virginia Twenter claimed she was with during the same time her parents were murdered. Her only other alibi was her friend, Linda Turner.
I walked in the door a little after 11 o'clock, And Mike Turner told me that Linda Turner called. And I said, well, I really need to talk. Because I needed to tell somebody what I had did.
She had said she had been at Polo's. I think she ran into a boyfriend that she had just broke up with. And then she had talked about meeting a couple of guys. And she left with them for a while.
The problem with Linda's testimony for the defendant is she picks up at about 11:15 p.m. and then goes on through the next couple hours. Linda's testimony doesn't help the defendant during the two-hour gap between 9 and 11:15.
What worried investigators is that Linda Turner also described a route that passed right by both crime scenes. Most suspicious was the sudden activity in Virginia's bank account.
On the morning that Virginia Twiner's parents were discovered dead, she had a $4,400 check payable to Malmo Motors to take care of a bad check she had given there. And she had a $4,000 check, which I believe was payable to herself, and she used that to take care of a number of other bills.
Witnesses say Virginia had also given conflicting accounts about where the money came from.
There were three or four or five different versions of events that she gave, such as, my dad gave me the money and I made the deposit. My dad and my former husband Hugo gave me the money and I made the deposit.
According to Virginia, her father told her to keep quiet about the loan, worried his other seven children might also ask for handouts.
When people asked me where I was getting the money, I never told anyone the truth because that was one of the things my dad asked me not to do.
Investigators asked to conduct a search of Virginia Twiner's home. The team collected a number of pieces of evidence, including a pair of tennis shoes.
Linda's the one who actually said, Jenny, I think they're starting to suspect you.
When Women Behind Bars continues.
I didn't understand why I was sitting in his chair being charged with two counts of first-degree murder of my parents.
And later in this episode of Women Behind Bars, the murder of a mother of four.
We know somebody suffocated Martha, wrapped her in a blanket, wrapped cord around it.
Three days after J.D. Wells and his wife Marilyn were shot to death near Sedalia, Missouri, their 26-year-old daughter Virginia Twiner was arrested and charged with carrying out the brutal double homicide.
We developed several different people who might possibly have been involved. One of the people who we looked at pretty hard was Virginia's ex-husband was being involved. His alibi was that he was at work at the fire station at the time of the killing, which is a pretty good alibi for him.
All of those financial troubles are over after her parents are killed, and then she's lying about the trail of money, all caused her to come into focus as a suspect.
We talked to the other people, and one at a time eliminated them until she was pretty much left.
I just couldn't believe this was happening to me. I mean, my parents was dead, okay?
I think she had severe money problems. She didn't see any way out. Perhaps she thought that her dad would bail her out again. Maybe there was a confrontation.
Virginia would stand trial without the support of her siblings.
Their reactions was strong that Jenny was guilty because that's what sheriff's deputies had told them.
On December 9th, 1988, Pettis County Prosecutor Jeff Middlehauser presented the case to a jury, a case that was based almost entirely on circumstantial evidence.
I tried to be fairly careful not to emphasize a single piece of evidence because in my mind, this didn't boil down to one smoking gun.
Investigators from the Missouri Major Case Squad had failed to find any fingerprints inside the Wells home. Nor did a scrap of denim left at the second crime scene match up. An expert also testified that while Virginia's tennis shoe was similar, it was not an exact match to the bloody footprint found at the crime scene.
The biggest problem to me was helping the jury understand the whole picture and not just looking at the bloody shoe print and saying, Well, yeah, Virginia Twiner had a pair of shoes like that, but 10 other people might have bought the same pair of shoes in the same size.
Even though the state put forth an expert that testified he couldn't positively say it was Virginia Twiner's case, the jury was left with the information that she had shoes that matched.
Virginia also smoked Marlboros, the same type found at both crime scenes. And then came the murder weapon. Ballistics tests showed it belonged to Virginia's ex-husband, who'd reported the gun missing 2 weeks earlier. Testimony reveals he suspected his ex-wife of stealing it.
That handgun was found approximately 2 miles from her residence. You have the murder weapon now that matches up with the ballistics, the bullets that were recovered, and Virginia Twiner had opportunity or had access to that handgun.
A second search of Virginia Twiner's home had also turned up a puzzling item.
We got a search warrant for her home, and it was served May 6th or May 7th. Under her waterbed mattress, they found a cash register tape from the business that J.D. Wells ran. It was dated May 3rd, and that would have been the last day's worth of cash register receipts. It's important because J.D. was sitting at his table when it appears he was interrupted and then shot on the night of May 4th.
I didn't think I'd even go to trial, and then when I did go to trial, I knew they couldn't get a conviction. I wasn't guilty, okay?
Would the mountain of circumstantial evidence be enough to convince a jury to find Virginia Twiner guilty of 2 counts of capital murder?
I believe it was a small town, it was election year, and it looked good for them to have somebody in jail for these murders. I think to them, they didn't care. Jenny was as good as anybody else.
The jury found the defendant guilty of both counts of first-degree murder. We then proceeded to a penalty phase, and the jury recommended life without parole for killing John Wells, and they recommended the death penalty for killing Marilyn Wells.
Hours after the verdict, Virginia reportedly attempted to commit suicide by taking an overdose of pills.
There's no possible way for anyone to even begin to comprehend the intensity of another human being or a judge or anyone saying death sentence.
She was given a new trial by the trial judge because he felt that there was numerous things that the trial attorneys did in this case that were ineffective. Witnesses that weren't talked to, family members that weren't talked to, things that weren't investigated that should have been.
The prosecution challenged that ruling, and Virginia's appeal went all the way to the Supreme Court. The court ruled against a new trial, but reduced her sentence to 2 life terms without the possibility of parole. In 2005, another team of defense attorneys, Phil Gibson and Mark Thomason, agreed to take on her case one more time.
It just didn't seem to me that, based on the facts, that she could have been the person that committed the crime.
There was never another person identified, there was never another person brought into trial on these cases, but that it was just Virginia Twiner. We're involved with this case for the long haul, and if that means we're on it for another 10 years, then we'll be doing it for 10 more years.
Separate from Twenter's attorney's work, journalist and teacher Ellen Harris reviewed Virginia's case with a group of her students at University College in St. Louis.
I don't believe Virginia Twiner received a fair trial. I don't think she received a fair police investigation. I think there was a rush to justice, and it was rural justice.
Virginia's attorneys are hoping to retest the evidence for DNA. For now, they're relying on old-fashioned detective work.
What we're going to have to do in this case is find who did it. And that really is probably Virginia Twiner's only case of proving her innocence.
Virginia says 20 years behind bars has taken its toll. She's had almost no contact with her children or siblings.
I think 19 years without your children, she'll never get that back. Her life has changed forever, and she can't get that back.
I don't believe in my heart that I would spend the rest of my life in prison. I believe eventually somebody will come forward, something will be found, something, and I'll be vindicated.
Next up on Women Behind Bars, a woman is accused of murdering her husband's ex.
I was like, okay, where's Marty? And he said, she's dead. And I just, at that point, everything started to move in slow motion.
For more information about Women Behind Bars, go to www.wetv.com. On August 18, 1974, 29-year-old Martha Metzger, known as Marty, was beaten, strangled, and suffocated in her home in a Philadelphia suburb. A month later, her decomposed body was found in a shallow grave near Buffalo, New York.
I observed the grave in the backyard. I'll never forget. It sends chills up and down my spine to this day.
According to investigators, Marty's husband, Frank Metzger, and his then-girlfriend, Diane Hamill, killed her. The prosecution alleges that Diane wanted Marty dead.
She was so obsessed with him, but she was also obsessed with the fact of getting Marty out of the way.
She got involved in a situation that wasn't her doing, made a foolish decision to stay with the person she was in love with at the time, and, you know, it just went horribly, horribly wrong.
Was Diane Hamill Metzger guilty of murder, or was she an accomplice blinded by ill-fated love? Ridley Park, Pennsylvania, a town 17 miles southwest of Philadelphia. Diane Metzger was born in 1948 and grew up in this quintessential small American town.
I was made aware very young that my dad wanted a boy. As a result, I was always a tomboy. I always tried to be like the, you know, best in sports and all to make him like me.
When she was growing up, she never gave me a problem. Such promise, I guess I'd say, because she always did so wonderful in school.
Fran Stafford went to school with Hamill from kindergarten to 12th grade.
I just remember Diane was, you know, one of these people that always did everything she was supposed to do, straight A student.
The kids thought I was a nerd and homely and, you know, even to get to go to a school dance, I usually had to ask a boy.
When Diane graduated high school, instead of going straight to college, she decided to take a year off. She got her own apartment and an office job. She also took and passed the Mensa exam, a national testing program for those who have IQs of more than 130.
I might have had an IQ of 150, but my emotional IQ, I was like 14.
Diane was still just a teenager when she met Frank Metzger at work. He was a chemist, married with kids. She was a statistician's assistant. Frank was 30, Diane was 18.
He just started to pursue me after that. I was kind of amazed and flattered and surprised. And I had never had that happen before. And I think it was like because he was older, it was more the daddy type figure.
Diane enjoyed Frank's intellect. With an IQ of 150, he also joined Mensa on her suggestion. They dated, according to Diane, while Frank was legally separated from his wife, Marty. Frank and Marty had four sons who lived with their mother in Middleton, Pennsylvania. Their neighbor, Colleen Plyler, babysat the boys when she was 17.
They were very normal, very wonderful children, and they had a very good mother. She was a very happy. She had a lot of trouble in her life, and we would never know it because she always looked at the bright side of things.
In 1970, 1 year after Diane met Frank, they moved in together. But financial trouble soon began to take a toll on their relationship.
We pretty much had to live on my salary because he was not only paying support for his children, but he was also trying to pay bills that, you know, he had incurred with Marty.
I don't think he was giving her anything at the time because they certainly didn't have anything.
Diane claims that Frank's estranged wife got him arrested for not paying child support.
He did not like that at all. So he got very mad and started calling her and harassing her over the phone and calling her names and that sort of thing because he didn't think that was right for her to do that.
Diane also claims that Frank paid Marty in cash, but he had no way of proving it to the court, so he and Diane fled to Florida to avoid authorities. In the spring of 1973, Diane learned she was pregnant. She says Frank called Marty to see if their divorce had gone through.
She told him on the phone at that point that she was sick of waiting for the divorce to go through and that she had gone down to the islands and gotten one of those quickie divorces. Now, this is what she told him. I never saw any paperwork.
There's no way she went to any island to get a divorce. She didn't have money to go down the street to go to the McDonald's.
Diane and Frank then got married, but the marriage would later be considered invalid because Frank could not prove he was divorced from Marty. In November 1973, Frank and Diane moved to upstate New York, eventually settling in an old farmhouse in a Buffalo suburb. 3 months later, their son Jason was born.
Wonderful, my whole life. You know, he was just my world.
But Frank missed his other sons.
They did love their father. They were confused and upset and disappointed because he just took off like that and they didn't see much of him.
Diane claims Frank devised a plan to drive to Pennsylvania with Diane and their baby and simply talk to Marty about getting custody. The plan did not include murder. Frank rehearsed with Diane what he would say to Marty to get custody.
If you don't be reasonable, I'm just going to go away for good and you're never going to see me again and then you won't have anything.
Although she says she was hesitant, Diane gave in to Frank's plan. Around midnight on August 18th, 1974, after an eight-hour drive, they arrived at Marty's house.
He backed into the driveway, and he said, I'm going in the back door because she never locks that door.
Diane claims she waited in the car with their baby and watched as Frank went into the house with a flashlight in his hand.
Next thing I know is I'm kind of even like nodding off a little bit in the car, and the baby's asleep, and I hear the trunk open. So I don't see him, but I hear him, and I hear like a thump. And it sounded like luggage was being put in the trunk, right? He came around to the passenger side and he was just crazed.
Colleen Plyler had her bedroom window open that summer night in her house across the yard.
I remember waking up at like 3 o'clock in the morning and hearing voices and listening. And I thought for the life of me, I couldn't understand why I heard Frank Metzger's voice. Then I thought, you're dreaming.
And I opened the door, I was like, what? He says, come on, you gotta help me get the boys up. You gotta come on. And I was like, okay, where's Marty? And he said, she's dead. And I just, at that point, everything started to move in slow motion.
Diane says she went into the house with Frank and helped get the boys dressed and into the car. He told them their mother went away. On the drive home with Marty's body in the trunk, Frank gave Diane the grisly details of the murder.
He went into the bedroom and she, you know, jumped up and came to the edge of the bed and said, what are you doing here? Get out of my house. And he said, wait, I'm just like here to talk or whatever. And she gets cussed him out, called him whatever, and ran for the phone. And he's like, don't do that. And she kept going, and he hit her with the flashlight. He had like a big police flashlight.
Prosecutor Ed Weiss strongly disagrees.
I think this thing about Frank going in by himself and hitting her with a flashlight is an invention by Diane. He might have had a flashlight, but they were breaking into the house in the middle of the night to kill Martha and to kidnap the children. You don't turn on the lights.
But according to Diane, Frank told her that when he hit Marty over the head, she fell unconscious onto the bed.
She was bleeding from the mouth. And so he said he ran into bathroom and got a wet wash rag and like put it in her mouth because he didn't want her bleeding everywhere.
An autopsy later revealed Marty died of suffocation by swallowing part of the wash rag. The prosecution believed the murder was premeditated and that Diane was the mastermind behind the murder.
I know somebody went upstairs and suffocated Martha. He wrapped her in a blanket, wrapped cords around the blanket. Now, it seems to me, in a fit of passion, you don't happen to bring with you some cords with you to wrap somebody in a blanket. And I had the strongest feeling that she was the prime person who actually planned the murder.
When they got home, Frank buried Marty's body in their backyard while his son slept. Diane watched as he dug the grave. She says she thought about going to the police, but decided against it.
I knew my husband would get in a whole lot of trouble. Just trying to keep the family together.
The next day, Colleen Plyler discovered Marty and the boys were missing when she came to visit. Her father called police.
The state police came and they looked around and they apparently didn't see anything suspicious about it.
Almost 6 weeks went by before police suspected something was wrong. During that time, Diane, Frank, and their infant son, along with Frank and Marty's four boys, lived at the farmhouse in upstate New York. When word reached them about the investigation, Diane and Frank took the five boys to a motel in the next town.
This is a Dunkirk motel, which is the next little town over, and we just stayed in there and waited.
2 days later, Frank decided they should leave the boys behind and make a run for it.
I said, what about the kids? And he says, no, we leave them here, we gotta go.
But Diane refused to go without her baby. Frank gave in to her demand.
I don't know what else I could have done for the boys at that time. I mean, Frank was running the show, they were his kids.
3 days later, the boys, ranging in ages from 4 to 11, were discovered.
The initial report came in that four young boys were found abandoned in a motel. The children led the police to the farmhouse. Martha's body was discovered buried in a shallow grave behind the farmhouse.
When Women Behind Bars continues, the nationwide search for the fugitive couple begins.
I willingly tried to help him, but I had no idea anybody was going to be dead that night.
In September 1974, 26-year-old Diane Metzger and her husband Frank became the focus of a nationwide police search. They were wanted in connection with the murder of Frank's ex-wife, Marty, a month before.
Of anybody you could have thought in high school that would have gotten in that kind of situation, everybody was shocked.
For almost a year, the Metzgers and their 18-month-old baby, Jason, eluded police by constantly moving around the country. But on July 11, 1975, the FBI found them in Boise, Idaho. The couple was arrested, brought back to Pennsylvania, and both charged with first-degree murder, burglary, and kidnapping. Jason was sent to a foster home and was later adopted by Diane's parents.
When the social worker came in that night, she just literally snatched him right out of my arms.
Frank Metzger confessed to the killing and waived his right to a trial. A judge sentenced him to life without parole. But there was more public interest in Diane's trial and why she chose to shield her husband from the police and go on the run with him.
I just didn't want to lose my husband. I knew he was in really, you know, in deep. And it's just like you just keep going until they actually stop you.
In February 1976, Diane Metzger's trial began at the Delaware County Courthouse. She was tried under the accomplice liability law, which finds a person who assists in a crime as guilty as the person who actually commits the crime.
She may have known after the fact what happened, that Frank had killed Martha. But in the eyes of the law, she was there. That makes her guilty.
Reporter Barbara Ormsby was there when Frank Metzger took the stand, claiming he, not Diane, was the one that murdered his ex-wife.
He seemed remorseful in the beginning. He just told the story of what had happened, how he went in and didn't intend to kill Martha. He just wanted to take the boys and get out of there.
But the prosecution presented testimony to the contrary. One of Frank's own sons said the night of the murder, he woke up and saw an unidentified couple on the stairs. Neighbor Colleen Plyler recounts the Metzger son's testimony.
He woke up and he heard shouting from the room and all the commotion, and he heard someone hollering, kill her, kill her. And Diane was in the house and was helping him hold her down. That's what the little boy said.
Defense lawyer Art Donato says the young boy's testimony was unreliable because he could not say for sure if it was Diane who was in the house.
As a general proposition, when anyone, in particular a young child, is awoken from a sound sleep, their initial perceptions are not reliable beyond a reasonable doubt.
Diane took the stand and maintained she never went into the house during the killing and had no knowledge Frank would kill Marty.
Yes, I willingly tried to help him, you know, and cover up and ran with him, but I had no idea anybody was going to be dead that night.
But the jury didn't buy Diane's side of the story and found her guilty of first-degree murder as a co-conspirator and of kidnapping and burglary. She was sentenced to life without parole.
Disbelief. I think I was numb for weeks.
No one seemed to think there was any chance that she could be found guilty of the same crime as Frank. They were assuming it would be some sort of accessory after, you know, after the fact, and it would be some sort of, you know, minor sentence or something.
6 years later, in October of 1982, the state Supreme Court overturned Diane's conviction after a procedural error, which potentially weakened her defense. This time, while awaiting her retrial, Diane got out on bail her parents posted. Attorney Art Donato, 3 years out of law school at the time, defended Diane in her second trial in June of 1983.
There was clearly enough evidence to show that she was helping him after the fact, but that doesn't make one guilty of a murder as an accessory.
There was no new evidence in the retrial that proved Diane was involved in the killing, but prosecutor Ed Weiss argued that Diane had a reason to kill Marty. The motive was financial.
Diane resented the fact that Martha was draining Frank's finances. I had no doubt that she was the actual killer. I had no doubt that she was the one who planned. This was a premeditated crime. Twice this woman has been convicted by a jury, two separate juries, of first-degree murder. The juries in each case had no question in their minds about her guilt.
She was sent back to a Pennsylvania prison with the same sentence of life without parole.
She took a life, and that's what she got in return, her life, an eye for an eye.
Diane Metzger has lived most of her life in prison. She's now 59 and has spent 32 years behind bars.
When I got there and I realized, you know, I might be there for a long time, I just didn't want to waste my time. So since I had never gotten to college, I found, you know, I started seeking ways to do that.
She's received four college degrees, including a master's degree in the humanities. She's also a published writer and poet.
She was the prisoner of the year, so stated by the Pennsylvania Prison Society.
For the past 12 years, Diane has been at the Baylor Women's Correctional Institution in Delaware to be closer to her brother and her ailing parents. She still keeps in touch with Frank Metzger, who is in a Pennsylvania state prison. Frank and Marty's four boys were adopted by a couple in Pennsylvania. Diane now keeps busy working as a clerk in the prison's treatment services department.
She is extremely good with the teenagers, or say the young ladies who come in with her type of offenses.
The warden at the prison says Diane has been a good worker and a model inmate, which has earned her a private cell in the Lifer's Honor Pod.
As you can see, we don't have a whole lot of space here. Hang up our outgoing clothes here. It's kind of my food and drink utensils, chair, and my TV.
During the 32 years she's been in prison, Diane has applied 8 times to the Pennsylvania Board of Pardons to have her life sentence reduced to time served. Ernie Priate, the former state attorney general, championed her fight for freedom in her 2004 application.
It's almost 4 inches thick. I don't think anybody ever submitted an application like this to the Board of Pardons.
The board approved Diane twice for a reduced sentence, but both times the governor of Pennsylvania denied it. She continues to fight for her release.
A life sentence is a death sentence in Pennsylvania. Lifers don't get out except when they get taken out by the undertaker.
Without clemency, Diane will die in prison. She has this to say to the Metzger boys she and Frank abandoned when they were on the run.
You didn't deserve this, and I wish I had been a better person to try to do something for you to keep this from happening. I made terrible decisions. I didn't take them into consideration. But boys, I am sorry. And I only wish I had done better by you.